From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo leaves Thursday for North Korea amid reports citing intelligence officials that say Pyongyang is either expanding or intent on keeping some of its nuclear weapons capability. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders remained upbeat on progress toward the North's denuclearization following last month's U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore.
In the last 8 months, you haven't seen missile launches, you haven't seen the nuclear detonations, and again, these conversations are continuing to evolve. I'm not going to get into the details, but I can tell you that progress continues to be made.
Another U.S. spokesperson reaffirmed Monday the goal remains the final fully verified denuclearization of Pyongyang as agreed to by leader Kim Jong-un. Korea Society Senior Director Stephen Norper said the Pompeo trip is in part motivated by growing concerns over Pyongyang's intentions.
But it's also early in the process, and this will be a very long path ahead that will be complicated and will require numerous meetings and monitoring of steps forward. And it reminds us that declarations of what they have and verification of dismantlement will be very key to the processes.
Sunday, White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said most of the North's weapons of mass destruction could be dismantled in a year. More allegations of scandal surround Malawi's top leaders. President Peter Mutharika reportedly has been implicated in fraud involving a food contractor, according to a leak from the country's anti-graft body. The opposition has called for his resignation ahead of next year's election. Ivory Coast is planning to build a biomass power generation plant that runs on waste from cocoa pods, part of a plan to diversify its electric power generation, which the world's top cocoa producer exports to neighboring countries. This is VOA News. As Iranian President Hassan Rouhani arrived in Europe Monday to shore up support for the international nuclear agreement with Tehran, the U.S. announced a timeline for a return to sanctions reimposed after the U.S. decision to pull out of that deal 2 months ago. The State Department's Director of Policy Planning, Brian Hook, announced the timeline for the first phase, August 4th, including Iran's automotive sector and trade in key metals. The second will be November 6th and target the energy sector.
More than 50 international firms have already announced their intent to leave the Iranian market, particularly in the energy and financial sectors. We have been clear with countries and companies around the world that we are bringing severe economic pressure on Iran until the regime changes its destabilizing policies.
Hook said the Iranian people are reacting to the country's economic decline.
The Iranian people are rightly frustrated with the regime, and they are expressing their frustration in nationwide protests and in smaller acts of defiance throughout the country. The United States stands with the Iranian people.
Hook said he's confident there is sufficient global spare oil capacity to make up for reducing Iranian oil exports. President Trump also said he has a great talk Monday with Mexico's president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who won in a landslide election victory Sunday.
I think he's going to try and help us with border. We have unbelievably bad border laws, immigration laughs, the weakest in the world, laughed at by everybody in the world. And Mexico has very strong immigration laws, so they can help us until we straighten out our immigration laws, which have been bad for many, many years, decades, and we're going to have them taken care of.
In a tweet, Mr. López Obrador said he proposed to Mr. Trump a comprehensive deal to create jobs, lower immigration, and improve security. The UN says the number of people forced from their homes in southwest Syria in the face of a Russian-backed government assault on rebel positions has risen to 270,000. It said most have taken refuge in villages near the Israeli and Jordanian borders. 12 boys and their football coach have been found alive by rescuers huddled inside a cave in Thailand 9 days after they disappeared.
How many of you? 13. Brilliant. We are coming. It's okay. Many people are coming.
The boys aged 11 to 16 disappeared after football practice June 23rd after setting out to explore the Tom Luang Cave, sparking a large multinational rescue effort. Malta has detained a second humanitarian vessel that has been used to rescue migrants off the Libyan coast headed to Europe. Meanwhile, the German government coalition reached a settlement dispute over migrants that threatened to topple the administration of Chancellor Angela Merkel. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, July the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we're covering. The United States says that it has cut funding to three Zimbabwean civil action groups. They're citing possible misuse of money. This is ahead of the July 30 elections. And the terrorist group Nusrat al-Islam wal Muslimin, an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Mali, has claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack in the town of Gao. That attack left four civilians dead. And Malawian President Peter Mutharika faces a growing corruption scandal after a leaked report from the country's anti-graft body accused him of fraud. Now, civil action groups and the main opposition party is calling on him to resign.
I can confirm that Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, president of the Malawi Congress Party, has called on Peter Mutharika and his entire administration to resign over allegations of fraud that have been leveled against him.
Eisenhower Mkaka is the Malawi Congress Party's Deputy Secretary General and spokesperson for the main opposition party. And this week, the Ugandan government started implementing a new law that forces mobile users to pay taxes to use mobile money and social media apps like Facebook and WhatsApp. Many Ugandans say that they can't afford to pay the 200 Ugandan shillings, which is an equivalent to 5 cents in US dollars.
I cannot incur 200 shillings just all of a sudden. That's a big amount of money per day, and I'm being shy for even paying that amount of money.
That is Kampala resident Lilian Mugambe. And in Gambia, it has been a challenging couple of weeks as the government of Adama Barrow struggles to cut the country's massive debt and fight corruption. Those stories plus a World Cup update are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. government says that it has cut funding to three Zimbabwean civil action groups, citing possible misuse of money. That's ahead of the July 30 elections. This will be the first vote since Robert Mugabe was ousted last year. The United States Agency for International Development, USAID, reduced its support for the Zimbabwe Human Rights Association, ZIMRights, the Election Resource Center, ERC, and the Counseling Service Unit, CSU. Oke Machisa, director of ZIMRights, confirmed the cuts, but he vowed to continue the work. The terrorist group Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Mali claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack in the town of Gao. That attack left four civilians dead. The group Nusrat al-Islam wa Muslimin, known by the acronym JNIM, said it carried out the attack Sunday in Gao, declaring in a message to French President Emmanuel Macron ahead of the African Union summit in Mauritania. Sunday's attack targeted a French and Malian patrol in Gao, leaving four civilians dead and over a dozen others, including four French soldiers, wounded. Now we go to the Gambia, where analysts say that these past couple of weeks have been quite tumultuous in the country's politics, from the killings of two environmental activists killed by paramilitary forces during protests against a sand mining company, the resignation of the Inspector General of Police, and a price dispute between the local bakers and the Ministry of Trade. President Adama Barrow reshuffled his government on Friday, sacked his prominent vice president in an unprecedented move that analysts say are part of his reform agenda to reduce the country's massive debt and drive out corruption. From Gambia's capital, Banjul, I reached reporter and political analyst Sene Marena to contextualize some of these changes in his country.
Yeah, the president acting under the provision of the constitution, which empower him to hire and fire, made a major cabinet reshuffle for the first time since the coalition government came into power. The vice president, who was very instrumental in the coalition formation in the early days, was also relieved from her position and, replaced by a veteran politician Hussein Udabo, who was the foreign affairs minister and the leader of the opposition then, now in the coalition government, United Democratic Party.
Well, what can you tell us about the vice president who was sacked?
Fatoumata Jallow Tambadja is also a prominent Gambian politician and a human rights activist who rose to fame during the coalition government formation. She was a very instrumental figure. She established what we call the Concerned Gambians that persuade the opposition parties then to come together and form a coalition that later defeated President Jammeh. So he has been very, very prominent and instrumental in this transitional government of President Adama Barrow.
Okay, and did this move, did her sacking come as a surprise to her or to the public in general?
It came as a big surprise to Madam Tambadja herself and many other people who admire her leadership qualities and also who respect her for standing against injustice during the heydays of President Jammeh. But many people also welcomed this thing in Banjul here, saying that the decision by the president to sack most of the cabinet members, including the vice president, is a bold decision because they feel that the president hasn't been acting very strong in terms of taking certain decisions because it's a coalition government.
Did the president give any reason as to why this vice president and the other ministers were sacked?
No official reason was given by the presidency, but according to the secretary at the State House in Banjul, she said this is also part of wider reform agendas and change that President Barrow, promised elected during the campaign period.
And what can you tell us about the other ministers who were sacked? Together with this
one of the prominent ministers that was sacked was the leader of the former government that the former regime of Yahya Jammeh overthrew in 1994. It's called the PPP party. Omar Jallow is the leader of this party and he was part of President Barrow's coalition government. He was accused. He was involved in a fertilizer scandal that he sold expired fertilizers that has a potential to harm both animals and the public. He called a press conference and denied this allegation. So his sacking to many might not come as a surprise because of this scandal that President Barrow is trying to avoid in his coalition government.
Okay, so we understand the former minister of agriculture might have had some sort of a scandal hanging over him. There's some investigations of the sale of these fertilizers, but had the vice president had any type of public falling out with the president that you know of?
Actually, this is the worry and speculation of ordinary Gambians. They say what have, might lead the president to sack his one, his close ally, somebody who has been with him to all this, time. But many others also say unconfirmed reports and, sources are saying that there was a leaked audio that shows the interest of the vice president saying he has an interest to, be the president of the republic. So some might think that, his political or presidential ambition might be something also. But there is no official, statement from the presidency to say why she was sacked after serving 1 year as the country's vice president during the transitional period.
So there was some sort of audio that was leaked to the public in which the vice president expressed her intentions to run for the presidency. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. And also there was this online media publication in one of these online Gambian newspapers, alleging that the vice president has presidential ambitions.
Now, what has been the reaction of the people to these type of changes in Adama Barrow's government?
Yeah, many people here in Banjul, there has been mixed reaction to the entire sacking. Some people welcome the decision, saying that it shows that the president is in total control, and it's a decision that they said is long overdue because many of these ministers are underperforming, which is a reality. Some of the ministers were not performing to the expectation of either the president or the population that voted them into office.
Sene Marena is a political analyst and journalist. He's based in the Gambia's capital, Banjul. Uganda's social media attacks took effect this week The government hopes to collect $400 million in revenue from the tax. However, some in the country are worried about the impact of the tax on their freedoms and are petitioning the Constitutional Court, seeking the court to stop the collection of the newly introduced tax. They say that the tax is illegal and deprives citizens of their right to expression. And from Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
The new tax came into effect on 1st July, requiring users of social media to pay 200 Ugandan shillings daily, which amounts to 6,000 per month or about $2. Aaron Echiza, one of the lawyers representing the concerned citizens, says they want the court to nullify the law that introduced the tax.
We are saying that this tax court should scrap this tax by annulling it and order URA to stop collecting it and fault the government for having passed it in the first place because it offends media, fundamental human rights, freedom of expression. Before passing it, one, they should have ensured that it's necessary, but also they should have consulted people and ensure that they participate in its specific formulation.
URA stands for Uganda Revenue Authority, a body responsible for collecting taxes in Uganda. Chiza says social media tax stifles debate and dialogue among citizens. President Yoweri Museveni has said people use social media for rumor mongering. He also recently suggested a strict regulation on social media as one of the ways to curb crimes in the country. Godfrey Mutabazi, who heads the Uganda Communications Commission, or UCC, says the taxes are legitimate. He says the taxes are meant to increase government revenue, which will be used to improve infrastructure.
You cannot access social media if you don't have a network here, can you? That's right. So, and that network has been put in place by these investors you see here, our service providers. And they are earning nothing out of that one. The government is earning nothing out of that one. So we are saying, pay a little bit of that, of your income, to the investors, so that the government can also have a bit of that.
Equally, a newly introduced tax is a 1% levy on mobile money transactions. Kampala businessman Frederick Sale deals in airtime vending and mobile money transfer. He says has received very few clients since the new taxes were introduced.
For some of us, you have been doing businesses online, but you have to pay first taxes, of which taxes are too high. Those people are not online now because they are lacking the 200, the money to pay. Like customers, they are quarreling because of the increased tax, the rates, everything has changed.
Kampala resident Lilian Mugambe says most of her friends and relatives are now unable to use social media to communicate. She says she now relies on public Wi-Fi to access internet.
I cannot incur 200 shillings just all of a sudden. That's a big amount of money per day, and I'm being charged for even paying that amount of money.
And Mutabazi says UCC is working with telecommunications companies to block virtual private networks or VPN and other apps that grant users to bypass the social media tax. He says government bodies will meet in 2 weeks' time to evaluate how the tax is faring among citizens. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Islamist militants have been a major problem in Mali since at least 2012, when armed jihadists briefly took over the northern half of the country. But not all the young men who joined armed groups in the region, including Islamist ones, are motivated simply by religion. According to researchers, many join armed groups for reasons that are practical, which, if addressed, could provide some solutions to the conflict. Bram Postumus attended a recent conference on peace and security in Morocco's capital, Rabat, and has this report for VOA.
The threat from armed Islamist groups in the vast Sahel region seems to be worsening on some fronts. On Friday, an explosion and gunfire severely damaged the regional G5 Sahel Force headquarters in central Mali, killing at least 3 soldiers. On Sunday, in Gao, Mali's largest northern town, Islamist militants killed 2 Malian citizens and wounded 4 French military personnel. The support group for Islam and Muslims has now claimed both attacks, but names can be misleading. Some experts on the Sahel argue that those who join armed groups in the region are not primarily motivated by religious fanaticism. Ibrahima Maiga is a Malian researcher at the Institute for Strategic Studies. He says the main driver for many of the young men who join armed groups is economic.
Ce n'est pas nécessairement pour des raisons de pauvreté ou de chômage comme on pense.
People joining armed groups are not necessarily poor, he argues, but they have economic interests to protect, such as lucrative smuggling operations of petrol, cigarettes, food, medicines, cocaine, and even people. Or they simply want to protect their cattle against thieves. Human Rights Watch researcher Karine Dufka says that in parts of Mali there is insecurity on all sides.
I spent a lot of time speaking with villagers who live in Segu and Mopti regions, which is, you know, central Mali, and they mention a number of things. One of them is abuses committed by the security forces, not just the army, but also, you know, other members of security forces. They also talk about the lack of protection and how they feel vulnerable at the hands of armed bandits. And lastly, they talk about what they describe as endemic corruption that has gone on for decades. And interestingly, the armed Islamist groups have very strategically exploited those grievances with the state to recruit quite effectively large numbers of people from villages and towns in central Mali.
Maiga and his colleagues do not say that religion plays no role at all, but argue that the overriding motives are practical. Abdelhak Bassou is based at the OCP Policy Center in Rabat, Morocco, which recently organized a conference on peace and security in the region. He suggests a straightforward solution. Be as practical as the people you are fighting.
La population, quand il n'a pas de bénéfice, quand il ne voit pas ses intérêts, quand
like everybody else, the population of the Sahel want to see their needs met, Bassou says. And if this does not happen, people tend to rebel, and this can take many forms. In the towns and cities, you take to the streets, he says. But in the vast rural areas of the Sahel, this is clearly not going to work. So here the options are mafia-style racketeering networks, illicit trade, or armed groups, jihadist or otherwise. And very often these activities are carried out by the same people, says Bassou. Fighting corruption and establishing accountable authorities is no easy task for governments that struggle to provide even basic services of security, education, and healthcare. But fail to provide some hope for the future, argues Bassou, and you'll have an eternal rebellion on your hands. Call it Islamist or otherwise. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Bamako.
The Malawi Congress Party MCP, the biggest opposition group, has called on President Arthur Peter Mutharika to step down following allegations of corruption. Other opposition and civil society groups have backed the call after accusing the president of engaging in acts of corruption. The main opposition party's call came following a leaked report from the Anti-Corruption Bureau. The document recommends that President Mutharika should not be prosecuted due to a constitutional immunity, although he allegedly benefited from $200,000 deposited in an account he controls. The anti-corruption agency has disassociated itself from the leaked report, saying it has launched an investigation into the document. In an interview with VOA's Nightline Africa over the weekend, presidential spokesperson Gemme Kalilani rejected the allegation as without merit. For more regarding the demands for the president's resignation, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Eisenhower Mkaka, the MCP's deputy secretary general and spokesperson for the main opposition party.
I can confirm that Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, president of the Malawi Congress Party, has called upon Peter Mutharika and his entire administration to resign over allegations of fraud that have been leveled against him. We are looking at some companies that fraudulently supplied some items to the police and then they shared some loot with the president directly into an account in which he is a sole signatory and stuff like that. So we're saying we cannot have a president who participates in fraud and corruption.
That was Eisenhower Mkaka, the Deputy Secretary General and spokesperson for the main opposition party, MCP. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti. And now for some World Cup news with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We begin with our continuous coverage of the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Brazil and Belgium are the latest countries to book their tickets for the quarterfinals of this year's Summer World Cup in Russia. Neymar and Firmino were on target as Brazil beat Mexico 2-0 in their World Cup last 16 clash on Monday.
Neymar one-on-one. Let's see if the superstar can produce something special here. It is Neymar. Clever back heel to Willian into the area. Willian! Brazil score! Neymar! Neymar, one-on-one. Let's see if the superstar can produce something special here. It is Neymar. Clever back heel to Willian. Into the area. Willian! Brazil score! Neymar! Lovely play from Willian in particular there. And the occasion is illuminated by the Brazilian goal.
Mexico coach Juan Carlos Osorio hit out a superstar Neymar for acting following an incident in the second half.
It's a very little contact, and every single time the referee stops the game, the referee has a lot to do with it. Too many calls and allows for too many faking fouls.
Brazil will now face Belgium, who also moved through after surviving a scare against gallant Japan. Belgium fought back from 2 goals down to beat Japan 3-2 with an added time goal from substitute Nasir Chadli. Belgium became the first side to recover from a 2-goal deficit to win a World Cup knockout match since Germany beat England 3-2 after extra time in Mexico in 1970. Belgium were run ragged by Japan's side, solid in defense and willing to probe deep. Eden Hazard, who was named Man of the Match, said the Belgian side is yet to consider themselves as potential champions of the tournament.
It's too early to say that we can be champion. We have the capacity, we have the players to win trophies, so we never know. But now we need to think about this game. The game was very tough. We never give up, even after the 2-0 down. Great reaction from the boys. Yeah, just proud to play for Belgium today.
In Tuesday's fixture, England is in action against Colombia in the last of the round of 16 games. In the early kickoff, Sweden will play Switzerland, and Sweden has named the same side in their final 2 group games, but will have to make at least one change with whole midfielder Sebastian Larsen, who is suspended. He's likely to be replaced by either Genoa's Oscar Hiljmark or Seattle Sounders Gustav Severson. The wife of Sweden captain Andreas Granqvist is due to give birth on Tuesday, but he has hinted he will play regardless of any development. And that's the latest World Cup update on Daybreak Sports. I am Samson Omale in Moscow, Russia. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a great day. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clody and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Mvunganyi in Washington and wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on the 31st African Union Summit underway in Mauritania. The 2018 theme is Winning the Fight Against Corruption, a Sustainable Path to Africa's Transformation.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.